This is VOA News, reporting via remote. I'm Jeff Custer. A social media post by officials in Ukraine says a Russian missile strike on a suburban mall has killed at least two people, with about 20 people hurt, of whom nine are in serious condition. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Ukrainian officials say scores of civilians are feared killed or injured after a Russian rocket strike hit a crowded shopping mall in the central city of Kremenchuk. President Volodymyr Zelensky says he fears that the number of victims are unimaginable, citing reports that more than 1,000 citizens were inside at the time of the attack. Zelensky stresses the target presented no threat to the Russian army and had no strategic value. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Meanwhile, on the diplomatic front, the United States and other members of the Group of Seven leading industrialized economies imposed new sanctions Monday against Russia for its four-month invasion of Ukraine. These include measures to cut Moscow off from materials and services needed by its industrial and technological sectors. The White House said the U.S. will commit $7.5 billion as part of a G7 effort to help Ukraine cover its short-term budget needs. And the governments are making an unprecedented long-term security commitment to providing Ukraine with financial, humanitarian, military, and diplomatic support as long as it takes. The announcement came as G7 leaders met in Germany's Bavarian Alps, where they spoke by video link with President Zelensky. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told reporters the U.S. is finalizing a new military aid package for Ukraine that includes advanced air defense capabilities to help it shoot down incoming Russian missiles, such as those deployed to target several Ukrainian cities over the weekend and Monday's attack in Kremenchuk. This is VOA News. The special U.S. House committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol announced Monday it is calling a surprise hearing to present recently obtained evidence. The hearing, scheduled for Tuesday, comes after Congress left Washington for a two-week recess last week. Lawmakers on the panel investigating the 2021 insurrection said last week there would be no more hearings until July. The subject of the hearing is so far unclear. A spokesman for the panel declined to comment on its substance. The committee's investigation has been ongoing during the public hearings that started 3 weeks ago, and the nine-member panel has continued to compile evidence. Among other investigative evidence, the committee recently obtained new footage of then-President Donald Trump and his inner circle, taken both before and after January 6, 2021, from a British filmmaker, Alex Holder. Holder said last week he had complied with a congressional subpoena to turn over all footage he shot in the final weeks of Trump's 2020 re-election campaign. The filmmaker said the footage includes exclusive interviews with Trump, his children, and then-President Mike Pence while on the campaign trail, as well as before and after the insurrection at the Capitol. Last Friday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe v. Wade, the legal precedent that established a right to abortion in the United States, is expected to lead to abortion bans in roughly half the U.S. states, with some already taking effect. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Missouri became the first state to ban all abortions except in cases of medical emergencies. The 12 other states with trigger laws that would effectively ban all or most abortions, Arkansas, Idaho, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, and Wyoming. The laws are nuanced depending on the states, such as the case in Alabama, Arizona, and West Virginia. All Republican run, all sorting through various halts to abortion. The court's decision sets up the potential for legal fights between states banning abortion and those not over whether providers and those who help women obtain abortions can be sued or prosecuted. I'm Julie Walker.
A Norwegian court announced the suspect in Saturday's mass shooting during an LGBTQ festival in Oslo had agreed to be held in a pretrial custody for 4 weeks and would not appear in court as originally scheduled Monday. The court says 42-year-old Zanir Matapur, a Norwegian citizen originally from Iran, was arrested shortly after the pre-dawn shooting in Oslo's nightlife district and was held on suspicion of murder, attempted murder, and terrorism. Two people were killed and more than 20 were wounded in what the Norwegian Security Service called an Islamist terror act. The motive for the shooting is unknown, and Matapur has refused to explain his actions to investigators. Repeating the hour's top news story, a social media post by officials in Ukraine says a Russian missile attack struck a suburban mall that killed at least two people, with about 20 people hurt. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer. This.
This. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There was a kind of upsurge of the activities of the bandits. And this is coming at a time when farmers are planning to go back to their farmlands for the rainy season.
That was Ibrahim Dosara, the State Commissioner for Information in Nigeria's Zamfara State. Details coming up also. President Biden has extended permission for Liberians living in the United States, but at risk of deportation, to remain and to seek employment. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. A Human Rights Watch report released today says separatists in Cameroon are increasingly brutal in their attacks. The new report says separatists have committed murders, are using rape as a weapon, and have carried out at least 80 abductions since January. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Human Rights Watch reports that separatists have killed at least 7 people, injured 6, raped a teenage girl, and committed other grave human rights abuses in the English-speaking Western regions this year. The separatists also torched at least 2 schools, attacked a university, and kidnapped people, including 33 students and 5 teachers, according to the report published on Monday. Ilaria Alegrozi is Human Rights Watch's Central Africa researcher. She says an escalation of attacks on civilians, education, and health has exacerbated an already dire human rights situation in Cameroon's Anglophone regions.
The separatist groups have kidnapped more than 80 people since January, and this figure is more likely underestimated compared to the reality on the ground, given the challenges of accessing the regions, but also the widespread fear among the victims to denounce because of possible retaliations and reprisals. These are serious human rights abuses, and they continue in a context of increasing violence and impunity that facilitates and fuels other abuses.
Human Rights Watch says in April, separatists stormed the University of Bamenda campus in the northwest region, shooting in the air, causing panic among students and teachers, and leading to a stampede that injured at least 5 people. The report says fighters attacked the university for not observing a lockdown imposed by separatists. In April, armed separatists kidnapped 33 Roman Catholic seminary students for ransom in Bantuantai, southwest region, Human Rights Watch says. Capo Daniel is deputy defense chief of the Ambazonia Defense Forces, ADF, one of the separatist groups named in the report. He says fighters alone should not be blamed for the human rights abuses.
Criminal gangs have taken maximum advantage of the chaos of this war to carry out kidnapping for ransom. While there have been some few cases that involve some Ambazonian forces, it has mainly been as a result of lack of command and control by factions within our struggle that do not take their responsibility over those forces. And La République du Cameroun is ultimately responsible for the chaos.
Daniel said the ADF has laid out a code of conduct that forbids fighters from committing crimes and has punished fighters who committed offenses, including rape. Human Rights Watch says in February, fighters attacked a vehicle of the Cameroon Baptist Convention Health Services, killing a female nurse and injuring another female nurse and a male doctor, according to the report. The rights group also says separatists killed a Doctors Without Borders health worker in the southwest region after accusing him of collaborating with the military. Human Rights Watch says since the conflict began in 2017, government troops have also committed human rights violations, including torching of houses and villages, torture, rape, mistreatment, and incommunicado detentions. The Cameroon government has denied the claims. Separatists in English-speaking Western Cameroon launched their rebellion in 2017 with the stated goal of separating from this French-speaking majority country and setting up an independent state. The conflict has killed more than 3,300 people and displaced more than 750,000 others, according to the UN. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The Chief Justice of Nigeria has resigned today. The reason for Justice Tanoko Mohammed's resignation was not made public. He was appointed Chief Justice in July 2019, replacing Walter Onogan, who was prosecuted on corruption charges. Shortly after news broke of the resignation, President Muhammadu Buhari swore in Justice Alukaidu Ariwoola as acting Chief Justice. The Zamfara state government in northwest Nigeria has urged residents, especially farmers, to arm themselves against bandits. Ibrahim Dosara, the state commissioner for information, said in Gusau, the capital, the government is willing to help farmers secure basic weapons to defend themselves. He says the government has approved the recruitment of 200 additional community protection guards in each of the 19 emirates in the state. Dosara spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye about the decision to assist farmers arm themselves.
Yes, you see, recently, after we have succeeded in curtailing the issue of banditry, there was a kind of upsurge of the activities of the bandits. And this is coming at a time when farmers are planning to go back to their farmlands for the rainy season. And as a result, government felt it necessary to direct people to possess legal weapons so that they can defend themselves, especially in their farmlands, against the bandits.
Do we have an idea of the number of farmers in Zamfara, and what does Zamfara farmers produce that feeds the nation?
Zamfara state is a population of farmers. Almost 85 or 95% of people of Zamfara state are farmers. And we produce large quantity of rice, large quantity of grains like sorghum, like guinea corn, like beans. We also produce cash crops like cotton, like groundnut, and other crops for export. So Zamfara state is a population that provides large quantity of food and cash crops to the Nigerian populace. And they contributed significantly in the provision of food security, across the country.
Well, the report said that the state government has called for the recruitment of 200 additional community protection guards in each of the 19 emirates to strengthen security across the state. Can you expatiate on this, sir?
Yes, it's just like Amotekun.
Okay.
In the southern part of the country, where governors combined their forces to recruit the vigilante groups that will ensure security within the region. It is the same thing the Zamfara state government is doing, that initially we approved for the recruitment of 300 people in each of the 19 emirate councils. And now we saw the need, the reason to, increase the number to 500 in each of the emirates. And that is why we ordered for the recruitment of additional 200 community protection guards so that they will help in reinforcing the security operatives in the state.
That was Ibrahim Dosara, the state commissioner for information in Nigeria's Zamfara state. He spoke by phone from the state capital, Gusau, with journalist Mike Mbonye. U.S. President Joe Biden today extended permission for Liberians living in the U.S. but at risk of deportation to remain and to seek employment. A statement from the White House says the delayed enforcement departure process applies to people who meet certain requirements, such as having been in the country since 2017 or earlier. They must be eligible for what's known as temporary protected status, which is granted to certain groups of people fleeing war. That status can be taken away, however, if a person commits crimes or is deemed to be harmful to U.S. foreign policy. 61 years after his murder, the remains of Patrice Lumumba, an African nationalist and Pan-Africanist, are returning to Kinshasa, the capital of his homeland, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Lumumba helped the DRC gain its independence from Belgium in 1960 and became its first prime minister. He was ousted just 5 months later after taking office, and in January of 1961, soldiers reported to be under Belgium command killed Lumumba and two of his associates by firing squad. Later, the bodies were exhumed, chopped into pieces, and dissolved into sulfuric acid. The executioners admitted to keeping two of Lumumba's teeth and fingers as trophy. Only one tooth has been found. 61 years later, Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo returned the tooth to Lumumba's family during a ceremony in Brussels. Croo said the government accepted moral responsibility for the African leader's death. Since the return last week, Lumumba's remains have been honored in ceremonies around the DRC. Earlier today, Eddie Isango from VOA's French to Africa service gave us an update on the ceremonies.
The remains of Lumumba has been welcomed in Congo. Everybody is involved. Let me tell you, from the government to the men of the streets, everybody is involved. Today, the government, the prime minister, decreed the national funerals, national mourning. We have 4 days for that, starting today. And you know, everybody knew Lumumba in Congo, the Republic Democratic of Congo, like the national heroes. Everybody know the story, and everybody has been waiting for this to happen. But now on, it's like the feeling is scattered. People are sometimes sad, mostly to remember how he was killed and what he was trying to do for the country by his speeches, and how he ended by being not only shot, killed, but by being cut by the killers and dissolved in acid.
On Wednesday, the remains would be exposed at the Prime Minister's office for a ceremony. Can you talk a little about that?
Lumumba was the first Prime Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And this is what is done for any other Prime Minister that dies, even if they old, a former one. You know, in the what they call premature, the prime minister office, there is a building, but there is also a big garden where they've built all the statues for everybody who has been prime minister. So to honor him, they're going to bring the remains and expose that for a few hours, and then give him honors. Pay respect to the remains, and then it's going to be taken to the resting place.
So, Eddie, this is where is the final resting place for Lumumba's remains?
In Kinshasa, there was a place named Lumumba Place. Those who know of Kinshasa will know that there is a higher building that has never been finished, completed. It was destined to be the national TV building, But at this place, that is what Mobutu did. But after Mobutu, Laurent Désiré Kabila and other, they built a mausoleum, a statue, a big statue of Lumumba. And it's in this place that they built now a mausoleum. And they were going to place the tooth or the remains or the relics of his body at this place. It's a big place. There is, as I said, what they call in French, échangeur. So many roads coming across, and it's going to be in the middle of that.
That was my colleague Eddie Asango from VOA's French to Africa service speaking with me earlier today. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. South African authorities say the owner of a bar where at least 17 teenagers were found dead and four others died while receiving medical care is expected to face charges. Police investigating the mysterious deaths in Eastern Cape Province say they have not ruled out the possibility the teenagers were poisoned. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
South African police say they are investigating and awaiting autopsy results after the teenagers' bodies were found at a bar early Sunday morning with no visible cause of death. Brigadier Themba Nkosi Kinana is a police spokesman.
Whilst we understand the urgency of this matter, the anxiety of the public, in particular the affected families who want answers, we urge that we allow sufficient time for our detectives to finalize those investigations. I must also add that we have not made any arrest at this stage.
The Eastern Cape Police Board says the owner is expected to face charges. Police have not ruled out the possibility that the teenagers were poisoned. Kinana says half a dozen of the bodies were not immediately claimed.
We are making an appeal to parents or relatives who may have not seen their children since the past weekend to please make time to make inquiries. We are also calling upon parents whose children may have survived the tavern incident but are still feeling sick to please visit hospitals and clinics for medical checkups.
Police were called to East London's Eyobeni Tavern in Eastern Cape Province, where local media reported the bodies were found slumped on the floor and tables. The tavern's owner, Siyakangela Ndevu, told AFP news agency that patrons had tried to force their way into the bar despite it already being packed. But safety authorities were quick to rule out a stampede because of the lack of injuries on the bodies, some as young as 13 years old. 18 is the legal drinking age in South Africa. Lucky Ntamane is convener of South Africa's National Liquor Traders Council.
The owner had workers working there. He had bouncers. They could have seen, easily seen, that they were minors in that establishment. But this was allowed to happen because the owner put the profits before the people. We should never ever trade in license, ever in his life, in alcohol, ever in his life. The license should be revoked with immediate effect.
South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa expressed condolences for the families through his spokesman Vincent Magwenya.
While the president awaits more information on the incident, his thoughts with the families who have lost children. The president is, however, also concerned about the reported circumstances under which such young people were gathered at a venue which on the face of it should be off limits to persons under the age of 18. The president expects the law to take its course following investigations into the tragedy.
He added that the deaths were even more tragic as they happened during South Africa's Youth Month. Youth Month developed from the June 16 National Youth Day, when South Africa reflects on the massacre of students during the 1976 Soweto uprising against apartheid. Some of the dead in the bar were also students celebrating the end of mid-year exams. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
The U.S. Supreme Court decision to overturn its historic 1973 ruling on abortion rights has been received with mixed feelings in many African countries. While abortion is illegal in some countries, some women organizations fear the U.S. Supreme Court's decision might have repercussions for women and girls in Africa. Dr. Marlene Timmerman is chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Aga Khan University, Nairobi. She's also a board member of the Partnership for Maternal, Newborn and Child Health, the world's largest alliance for women's, children's and adolescents' health and rights. Douglas Mpuga reached her by phone in Nairobi, Kenya, and began by asking her why she was concerned about the court's decision.
So that, my concern is mainly that the vulnerable women in the U.S. to start with, but also in other parts of the world, because some countries might be influenced by that decision and turn back the rights of the women and the health of the women. And in my experience, I'm a Belgian obstetrician gynecologist who has worked in many places in the world, mostly in Africa, and I have seen many women die in my hands because they were admitted in the hospital with the consequences of unsafe abortion. Some of them made it, others are dying. So I'm very concerned that exactly the vulnerable women in the U.S. and in other countries as well, that they will go for unsafe abortions with all the implications for their own health. And the women who are well off, the kind of higher classes, they always find a way to get their abortion done.
Given that abortion is illegal in many countries, including in Africa, what does this U.S. Supreme Court ruling mean for those countries where abortion rights are still in place?
Well, in some of the countries, most African countries, abortion is illegal, but there is also a trend, and there is the society in those countries who are asking their leadership, their government, their parliaments to change the laws. Now, with that court rule now in U.S., I think it will become more difficult to get the abortion decriminalized in those countries that are struggling with it currently.
So in your view, personally, and for the organization where you're a board member, what should be the next step? What should be done?
Well, we should respect the women's rights and the women's health. And we know that criminalizing abortion is not decreasing the number of abortions. On the contrary, those countries who have a good sexual education of their young people, those countries who have access to family planning and, if need be, to safe abortion, they are the best students in the world class, and they do best in terms of they have the lowest rates of abortion. It sounds by criminalizing abortion, you are not going to reduce the number of abortions. Absolutely not. You are only going to increase the number of dangerous abortions. And women will die and women will suffer. You are not going to decrease. And there is very good statistics on that. Look at the Guttmacher Institute. They will show that in those countries where it's criminalized, the abortion rates are even higher than in countries where it's legalized. But the women dying are much higher in those countries.
That's Dr. Marlene Timmerman, chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Aga Khan University in Nairobi, speaking with VOA's Douglas Mpuga. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Johnny Walker, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.